Australia is rich and dumb and getting dumber. That was how the Australian Financial Review's Erin Patrick summarised the results of a new Harvard University study earlier this week, which suggested that Australia's economic complexity is on par with countries like Senegal, Uganda and Morocco. And boy, did this capture a great deal of attention. It dovetailed with discussions in Australia about the nature of the economy we are starting to develop as interest rates continue to drop and other unconventional monetary policies like QE, quantitative easing, loom large on the horizon even here. It's long concerned CSIRO chair David Thodey who made these observations back in March.
I think most would say if you asked about Australia, we've had a pretty good run. You know, we've done pretty well. So we look at things like, you know, there's 25 years of uninterrupted growth. But when you get underneath that, you know, this growth has been largely built off our resources base, as you would understand. And one of the things that's come very clear is we really lack economic complexity. Having a lack of complexity leaves you exposed to big shifts in the world's economy. But also, when you look at technology adoption rates, we're about 50% lower than other countries. Now, I should quickly say that we've invested a lot in research and in terms of the minerals sector, but in terms of general entrepreneurship, we have not invested a lot.
That was an edited extract of David Thodey's Manning Clark lecture at the ANU, and that took place ahead of the release of CSIRO's Australian National Outlook 2019, which warned that Australia faces a slow decline if we don't act now. It is becoming clear, I think, that we're heading into a new economic reality, one that might be here to stay, and I'll talk to Alan Koller about that in just a moment. The big question is, how do we learn not just to live, but to thrive in this new old world? To discuss this, I'm joined this morning by veteran financial commentator Alan Koller, who's been writing about this lately, and Chief Executive of CEDA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia, Melinda Cilento. Alan, Melinda, welcome to you both.
G'day, thanks.
What do you make of this assessment, first of all, that Australia is rich and dumb and becoming dumber? That was the Harvard Kennedy School Centre for International Development launching their report. Alan, I'll get your thoughts first. What was your response to that report?
Look, I think that Australia is a victim of what's commonly called Dutch disease, which is where an economy that relies on resources tends to lose its manufacturing and complexity because the currency goes up. And we saw that in around 2010-11 when the Australian dollar went to parity as a result of the commodities boom at the time. Mm. And as the Australian dollar broke through parity with the US dollar, that is to say one for one, we lost our car industry. And, you know, it's a kind of a common phenomenon in a way that that a high currency as a result of resources, you know, going well, crowds out other export industries. So, I think it's ridiculous to talk about us being dumb. I just think that that is a reflection of dumbness on the part of the person saying it, to be honest.
Right. But, I mean, I think it was summarised by, I think it was Erin Patrick, you know, in his typically sort of a strong language, that how, in effect, the inference to draw is that Australia sells almost nothing that requires a degree to make. Now, that was a pretty devastating old, and that seems to have really got the Twitter sphere going. And, you know, there's a whole lot of people anxious. That's what it really, it threw up, given that it came from Harvard, of course, this anxiety that was there that seems to be its own story itself.
Yeah, but I think that statement is stupid. I mean, I'm sorry, I just kind of, I'm not pointing at anyone in particular, but our mining industry is highly technical now. I mean, for a start, you need a degree in either engineering or geology or mining engineering. But also these days, all of the mines are basically high tech entities. I mean, I was talking to the CEO of Fortescue this week, Elizabeth Gaines, and she was saying that their trucks, they've got autonomous trucks now driving around the mines. They've driven more miles or kilometres autonomously than any other vehicle in the world. So, I mean, Australia is leading the world in mining technology and robotics in the mines. So it's just not true to suggest that in some way being a resources economy means you're dumb. It's ridiculous.
No, but I suppose it lends weight to that notion that we're a quarry primarily and that is what people feel it's got limits. How long can you be a quarry?
What I think is dumb. Look, yeah, that's true. We're a quarry, and what are we going to do? Say, no, we're not going to sell you our iron ore and coal. I'm sorry. I mean, what I think is a bit dumb is Peter Dutton slagging off the Chinese completely gratuitously. I cannot imagine what he's thinking, why he's doing that. I mean, this is our largest customer, not only for minerals but also for education and tourism. Mm-hmm. Growing rapidly, tremendously important for the Australian economy, and he gets up and has a go at them completely out of nowhere. Why? What's the point?
Now, I think we have, well, I'm going to come back to that, delve into that indignation a bit more. Melinda, I think we do have you now. Is that right?
Yes, you do.
Good, excellent. So what were your responses, given that CEDA does very good work in these explorations, to that notion that we were not developing the industries that you could expect, given the enormous wealth that we generate from iron ore and coal and oil and so on?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the first thing I'd say is that, you know, we may have deteriorated, if you like, in terms of our complexity based on those findings, but the broad result has been known for some time. You know, we have fantastic resources. They do dominate many parts of our economic activity and our exports, but it doesn't mean that that is all we are. And just picking up the conversation you were having with Alan, we do lead the world in robotics. And yes, we use them well in mining, but there are other opportunities. And I was involved in a conversation just this week around the Australian Space Agency. Now, that is an investment by the government. It's an investment by Australia in actually diversifying our economy based on the skills that we have in areas like robotics. Yes, it's maybe another type of mining, if you like, but there are ways in which we can grow and use these skills and things that we're really good at.
So that, you know, do you sense that people, when they receive that information, this is what we're intrigued by, that people heard that, a lot of ordinary folk who know that their jobs and their children's jobs depend on Australia sort of remaining very competitive, we've been sold that line, that they're highly anxious that this is not being developed sufficiently. Now, does that boost the confidence in the community about the sense that they're in a community that is self-starting or not?
Well, I think I don't think it boosts confidence, and I think it's one of the issues that we need to address. That, you know, my point about the space agency is that, you know, there are areas where we are absolutely leading the world and where the world wants to come to us and work with us. There is the woman who is colloquially known as Astronaut Pam, who you know, ex-astronaut, come to Australia, living and working in Adelaide. I know Woodside's recruited, you know, a gun out of NASA who he's chosen to be in Perth working with one of our Australian companies because it's got exciting opportunities before it. When you go and ask the community whether business investing in new technology is an issue of importance, they don't see it that way. They don't think it's that important. We need to capture the country's imagination about why this is important, why innovation and investment in innovation matter to the Australian community. And then we need to line up policy to make sure that we get more of it.
And then we clearly need to talk about it more, Alan. I mean, you know, you could use your famous graphs to describe whether this is occurring or not. I mean, clearly there is a real issue about Australians' belief in our own capacity to innovate.
Yeah, I think so. Look, there's a lot of activity going on with startups at the moment, and I'm sort of interviewing a lot of small companies these days, and you know, there is a tremendous amount of activity, but it isn't large. But one of the problems we have, I think, in this country is all the large companies are very concerned with paying dividends because of dividend franking, and so the payout ratio of the large companies of their profits tends to be 75 to 80% of their profits gets paid out in dividends. That means that there isn't much left for those companies, big companies, to spend money on R&D. So, you know, if you look at some of the big tech companies in the US, like Amazon and so on, and Apple, I mean, they're spending 10% of their revenue on R&D. Mm. I mean, we're nowhere near that level. And I think a large part of the reason for that is the dividend franking thing.
Right. And so... But the minute you raise that, I mean, that would be a highly, I mean, that has been discussed, whether we pay out too much in dividends. Is this around boardroom tables? Is this something that is a live debate in your view?
Well, yes, of course. There is constant tension about that. I think that executives, particularly technology executives, you know, are constantly putting proposals up to boards to, you know, to spend money. And I think a lot of the time get knocked back because they have to pay it out as a dividend. There are good examples of that. CSL is one of them. One of Australia's great companies spends a tremendous amount on R&D and is getting the benefit of that. But its dividend yield is like 1.5%. Whereas you know, that sort of the average yield of the top 100 companies is about 4.5 to 5%.
Yeah, Melinda, that's a very interesting aspect of this. Do you agree?
Look, I think it's an interesting issue that around which there are many points of view and conversations. I have to say, having sat on a board, it's not the way you know I felt that we were framing up our decision making, and we were looking for investment opportunities first and foremost. But I think there's, you know, one of the conversations I've had recently with a number of CEOs is the question of short-termism as well, which is, you know, are we too focused on short-term returns over long-term returns, and is that driving the right behaviours, or is it making people too risk-averse about investments that have a longer payoff period?
Yes.
I think the other thing I've got to throw in here, though, is the issue of skills. You know, innovation without and investment without skills is a challenge. And I'm in no way saying that, we're, you know, playing back into that conversation of are we dumb or not, but the thing that I hear repeatedly from CEOs and business leaders is they cannot get the skills they need in really important areas like data, data analytics, those types of things.
Yes, I mean, I just want to quote you both another article that I picked out from the Financial Review about a visit that Hans van Leeuwen, their correspondent in London, made to Poland. And he spoke to the Deputy Finance Minister because Poland is absolutely right behind us in terms of, I think, something like 20, haven't had a downturn in any quarter for 29 years or something. They're doing extremely well. Coming through the middle, as it were, we're not looking for investors who will open a factory and create 1,000 jobs. We have a very low unemployment rate. We're looking for investors to work with universities to do their R&D here in Poland, creating good quality jobs, building their supply chains here, and building production for exports. Now, I suppose, Alan Collett, that is the sort of smart behaviour that the Harvard School is trying to highlight.
Yes, of course. And, you know, and that's what David Thodey was talking about in relation to complexity, I guess. And that's really just I'm not sure what we can do about that. I do think that there needs to be more investment. And Melinda's right. I mean, there's a bit of a focus on short-termism. There needs to be more looking at long-term, being prepared to make long-term investments.
And look, one of the issues that you did write about recently, all of this is happening amidst this realisation, Alan, and I want you to develop it, that the era we're in now, post the GFC, is the new normal with very, very low growth, very low interest rates. And you, I think you've had a bit of a road to Damascus moment yourself, but you can tell me if I'm wrong, this is going to mean there's no risk-free investment now available. People are going to have to adjust their sights.
Yes, well, so obviously we're conscious of interest rates being terribly low at the moment, even lower somewhere else, other places in the world. We've got negative interest rates in a lot of places in the world. And I was just thinking perhaps a good way to look at this is that it used to be possible to get 6% in a term deposit or a government bond, which was zero risk. And to make the equivalent of the age pension, you needed, at 6%, you needed $500,000. But now, if you put the money in a term deposit, you're getting 1.5%. You need $2.5 million to make the equivalent of the age pension. Or another way to look at it is with investing $500,000 risk free, you'd make $290 per fortnight. So what I'm saying is that it's no longer possible, as it used to be, to make a living from what normal people would have as capital. Risk-free. You now have to take risk. You have to not put the money into a term deposit with NAB. You have to put it into NAB shares, and they will pay you 6% yield. But the trouble is that NAB shares went down 10% this month, and you lost, and you lost a couple of years' worth of dividends just this month. So it's kind of risky.
And the point is, your point is that this is what did really prevail for most of our recent history, that we've actually been living this anomaly period post-World War II, where we've expected growth.
Well, so that's the question. Is what we're going through now a cycle, or is it what's the economists call secular, that is to say, is it kind of permanent? I've been reading a lot of stuff, and it looks to me as if the period from World War II to the GFC was an anomaly. The average GDP growth rate was 4%. Average interest rates were above that for that time. But prior to that, GDP growth never got more than 2%, and in fact, for much of world history, was around 1%. And the reason for the for that spurt of growth between 1950 or so and 2007 were three things. One was a big increase in population growth, which has now ended. Secondly, a big increase in debt through the financialization of society. So the world became financialized. Wall Street took over from Main Street, as it were. And so everyone kind of borrowed. We've now got massive amounts of debt, which is finished because we can't have any more. And the third thing was the use of fossil fuels, which during that period fueled large machines, which increased productivity enormously. And so fossil fuels are out now too. So I think a lot of the things that drove that growth for those kind of 50 or 60 years have finished. And I think we're now going back to the normal of 2% or less GDP growth.
Now, I've just got to give Melinda a final remark. And one of our texters said Huawei invests 14 to 15% on R&D.
Yeah, no, I think there's a really big question. It's what I was talking about before around, you know, how do we start getting more of a focus on the importance of innovation, of investment in new technology, and how do we reframe the conversation? And I just have to pick up on Alan's point about, you know, the use of fossil fuels. You know, I was talking to a CEO the other day who was telling me that the rest of the world is more interested in our capabilities in hydrogen than we seem to be. Now, hydrogen's got, you know, a lot of interest now, but his point was we've got other countries coming to talk to us about their demands for that, and they seem to be ahead of us. So I think we need to just shift the conversation here, and we really, really need to get a focus on that.
Yes. Thank you both. Look, it's very interesting. Alan Kohler and Melinda Salento, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Alan Kohler, who I think is well known, doesn't need much more introduction, and Melinda Salento, whom we'll have back, is Chief Executive of the Committee for Economic Development of Australia, or CEDA.